and welcome to On a Good Day with me, Elizabeth Callahan.
And me, Julia Ajayi. This is a podcast which delves into brain injury and its impact on all involved.
We're partners of Brain Injury Survivors, helping others to navigate this life-changing journey. In this episode, we're looking at the importance of having proper legal advice following traumatic brain injury and the difference it can make.
We will be dispelling some myths around personal injury claims, getting insights into the process, and why getting a financial settlement isn't just about the money.
Today, we're talking to Richard Biggs and Adam Shelverton from Irwin Mitchell Solicitors.
Richard is a partner in the Manchester branch and is a solicitor who specialises in brain and spinal injury cases.
Adam is a physiotherapist by background and a team manager for Irwin Mitchell's support and rehabilitation services in Manchester. A big welcome to On a Good Day. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Richard and Adam. Great to have you here with us. Whilst Elizabeth nor I have had experience of engaging solicitors like yourselves, we know that some of our listeners will have or may need to do so. And so it's really important that people can get the right legal advice and help when they need it. So maybe we could start with just asking you when someone should come to a specialist law firm when they've had a traumatic brain injury.
Thanks, Julia. Well, I act on behalf of brain injury survivors who have been involved in accidents, in particular on the road or at work. And the answer to the question, really, when somebody should consult legal advice, if anybody has been involved in an accident and has suffered suspected brain injury, then certainly at an early stage, we always encourage our clients, where possible, to come and see us as soon as possible, because by engaging a solicitor at an early stage as possible following an accident, we can try to access the rehabilitation that person needs as quickly as possible to ensure as good an outcome as possible. Because we all know, no doubt, and all your listeners, I'm sure, are aware that the earlier the access to rehabilitation, often the better the outcome. So the answer really is as soon as possible and consult a solicitor to get that advice to see whether there is a viable case or not.
And my understanding is that can also include if someone's been assaulted as well as had an accident.
That's right. So there's a separate process which can be run. It's via something called the Criminal Injuries Compensation Authority, the CICA. But the CICA make awards for people who have been involved, unfortunately, in acts of criminal violence. So an application can be made through a solicitor as well. So again, it's worthwhile seeking legal advice as soon as possible after such an incident. The one thing I've mentioned, Julia, as well, in following such an assault, is the need for somebody to comply and inform the police about what's happened as quickly as possible, because if you fail to do so, then the CICA may refuse to make an award. So it's really important to report at any instance to the police as soon as possible after an assault.
That's really useful advice. Thank you.
And I'll just add, Julia, it might not just be a road traffic accident, accident work, or a criminal act itself. An injury might be as a result of some negligence of some sort from a medical perspective that may warrant a conversation with a solicitor and a lawyer in terms of seeing what potentially is on offer and can be accessed. So that might be another consideration as well.
Adam, that was exactly the question I was just about to ask. So thank you so much for covering that. If something like that did happen and they felt that the hospital had been negligent, what would they then do? So they would contact someone such as yourselves?
Absolutely. They'd contact someone such as ourselves or Richard. They would then take them through and see what might be possible and what the situation is. But as Richard said, the earlier that we can get involved, the earlier we can access the information, rehabilitation is really important. So if there is a claim and it's got potential, then we can investigate those options early on and access that rehabilitation as soon as possible, which is invaluable in terms of improving outcomes, but also supporting families as well, because we are acutely conscious it's often not just the individual. There is a family and there's a social element behind it as well, and it's not just one person that is involved.
Absolutely. And we will come on to that a little bit later as well. So if somebody feels that they do have a claim on a really practical level, what kind of information do they need to come and bring to you?
I think before we even get to the stage where somebody would consult a solicitor, I would encourage people to do their research, because acting for a brain injury survivor, it requires a level of expertise and experience that not everybody has. And I would encourage anybody who feels that they need to access legal advice to do their research and to look on the Law Society website, to look at league tables that are produced for solicitors, and just do some background research to ensure that the solicitor that you are approaching does have an expertise and experience in brain injury cases. So I think that's the first thing I would say is really important. The second thing, we when we initially are approached by a client, we really like to go and see, and I think it's absolutely imperative, really like to go and see a client and their family at home, because it's absolutely vital for the work we do, and really key that we understand how somebody is coping at home, how somebody's interacting with the family, how they're coping at work, whether they can access all parts of the house, or access the rehabilitation they need. So I think seeing somebody at home in their own environment where they're comfortable and where we can see how things are going on a day-to-day basis is absolutely key. And during that initial meeting, we always ask, of course, what happened, but we go into a lot of detail about life before the accident and how life has changed since, and what our client's potential short and medium and longer term goals might be. And that's something that I always ask in our initial meetings, just how can we help, and what are those goals? Is it to get back to work? Is it to access the community? And I think those questions are really important to understand and to work together collaboratively. And you notice perhaps, Elizabeth, I didn't talk about the legal case in that initial answer, because I think that's almost secondary. We talk first of all about, well, how can we start to get things back on track, rather than let's rush off to look at the litigation and going to court, because that comes second.
I think you've made a really good point there as well, Richard, that it's really important that people have access to the right kind of specialist lawyers such as yourselves, because it is a very specialised area.
You may have heard, Julia and Elizabeth, the phrase, if you've seen one brain injury, you've seen one brain injury. Because every case is different, and it requires expertise and a lot of experience to be able to deal with brain injury survivor cases properly and thoroughly and in the right way. Because when somebody pursues a claim, whether that's as a result of an accident or, as Adam was saying, as a result of medical negligence, you get one opportunity. You get one chance to pursue this case, because when cases are concluded, normally, there are a few exceptions, but normally it's on a full and final basis. So you have to have confidence in the person that you instruct, and you have to be able to trust that that person knows exactly what they're doing to maximise the case and to ensure the best outcome.
I was just going to take you back, Richard, to when you said about researching on the Law Society. I have to say that made me, that sort of struck slight terror into my heart, because the thought of doing research at a point of crisis, I think is very hard. But I do know that Headway has a list of approved solicitors that are specialist solicitors, like Erwin Mitchell and others as well. So Headway is also another place that people can gain that information. And we will put in our show notes some of the other places that people can find the information to make contact with specialist solicitors.
Absolutely, you're right that at a time of crisis, it's perhaps the last thing you want to do. But seeking recommendations or guidance from organisations such as Headway is a great idea. I agree.
Ask you, Richard, about no win, no fee, because it's a term that I think is, you know, bandied about a lot, and I've certainly had phone calls saying, oh, you've been involved in an accident, which I haven't been. And you know, it's something again that feels a term that I don't really understand, but also is something that I think may be part of this process as well. Could you just explain to me what that means and why it's appropriate?
Of course. And before I do that, if any listeners ever have a phone call saying you've been involved in an accident, put the phone down straight away, because no solicitor worth their salt would ever cold call somebody to say you've been involved in an accident. They're generally claims organisations that are trying to harvest cases, and it's certainly not a route I would ever advise anybody to go down if they have one of those cold calls. But no win, no fee. There's a common misconception, I suppose, on no win, no fee, that there's a percentage of your compensation taken at the end of the case, and that percentage is a set amount. And the way it works, so as no win, no fee would indicate, if you pursue a case and your case is unsuccessful, there's generally nothing to pay. So that's the starting point. That's the easiest, I suppose, way of explaining it. Now, this is the case. This has been the case for the last 11 years, since 2013, when the then government under David Cameron changed the rules, because prior to 2013, we were able to offer all of our clients a no-cost-to-you service, because we could say to our clients, well, win or lose, we'll enter this into this agreement and we will recover our costs from the insurer that we sue. That changed in 2013. So the position now is that if the case is unsuccessful, there's generally nothing to pay. As I say, if the case is successful, there is generally a deduction from the compensation at the end of the case. Now, I can't tell you what that deduction might be, because it is a percentage of something, and we don't know what that something is. But it's a percentage of our legal costs. So to give an example, and this is the way I explain it to clients, really, because it can be confusing. I say, if we pursue a case and we are successful, we are entitled to charge something called a success fee, which is a percentage of our costs, and that is deducted from the compensation. And the example I usually give is that if we have a success fee of something of around 20%, and we recover £100,000 in compensation, and our legal costs are £10,000, it is 20% of £10,000 and not 20% of £100,000. So the misconception is, when people say it's 20%, you're taking 20% or a fifth of my compensation. That's not the case. It's 20% of our costs, which are almost always lower than the compensation. Any solicitor should be regularly updating clients as a case progresses, so there's no nasty shocks at the end of the case. But it is a tricky discussion to have at the outset of any case, because firstly, we are all quite uncomfortable in talking about money and saying we unfortunately have to deduct money from the compensation. But it's also tricky because we have to say we have to deduct money from the compensation, but we don't know what that is. And it is so hard to say to somebody, there will be a deduction, but I can't tell you what it is, because understandably that can breed mistrust, really. But we are very transparent at Owen Mitchell, and we do update our clients as all the cases progress. One other thing I might just want to mention as well, Julia, is that with any no win, no fee agreement, we always take out a policy of insurance at the start of a case. A usual policy of insurance, say for home insurance or for motor insurance, that policy of insurance protects us against something happening. So it's called a before the event policy. So it protects us against being involved in an accident or something happening at home. With a no win, no fee agreement, we take out a policy of insurance called an after the event insurance policy, because it's insuring us after something has happened. And we take out a policy of insurance in a case to protect us, or to protect our clients rather, against the case being unsuccessful or us incurring costs which we can't recover. And that policy of insurance will pay out to protect our clients against any unsuccessful recovery. So it's protection, really. But the cost of buying that premium also comes from the compensation as well. But there are some deductions, in summary, from compensation at the end of the case, never beforehand, but only if the case is successful. In any case, the vast majority of costs are paid for by an insurer, not by somebody that's injured. And it's just that small percentage under the no win, no fee agreements.
And presumably you can't say kind of what percentage, because each case is different on how much time you're spending on it.
That's exactly right. Yes. Yeah.
I think it follows on from what you were saying, Richard, in terms of fee agreements and conversations around finances, for example, but also what you were saying, Julie, in terms of when something's happened, the last thing probably on your mind is engaging a solicitor or law firm. But I will say it's probably worthwhile investing the time, not just from a potential compensation perspective, but from a rehabilitation perspective. Because if there is a claim to bring, that then enables access to rehabilitation services. And that might be invaluable for an individual or family at that time in terms of accessing statutory services, or perhaps accessing private rehabilitation services to improve functional outcomes, but also quality of life. And that's something that we've got a service at Owen Mitchell that's quite unique in terms of we have support and rehabilitation coordinators. They are clinicians by background in the main, and they can support clients at a really early stage, whether that's accessing home equipment, accessing care in the community, accessing housing, accessing rehabilitation services, but also support and advocating for the clients and their families. So we can support clients at a really early stage. If their claim has got merit, and they then will be able to access private rehabilitation services, but we can support clients from a really early stage. And sometimes that is important, because often we might get calls from clients or members of the family at the darkest times. They might have been discharged from hospital, and what's next? What is the future? What does it look like? Because often it's not apparent at that moment in time. It's been through a traumatic event or experience, and sometimes people are at home or they're in a care facility, and it's often the not knowing what's next, what is possible from a rehabilitation or recovery perspective. And sometimes those conversations and exploring what is available and what the future might look like can be really empowering for people, but also accessing those is going to improve potential recovery, maximize quality of life. And often that's what's most important to people, not necessarily whether they're going to get compensation at the end, but improving what is often a really challenging and sometimes distressing situation.
Adam, that's a really good point. And presumably that won't cost anyone anything to make those initial to have those initial conversations. And I think that's something that maybe can put people off, because you have it in the back of your mind, the fees that lawyers can charge. And I think that can be often a stumbling block for some people.
It can be, but following on from what you said, I think if any solicitor or lawyers engage, having upfront conversations around costs is important. But from a rehabilitation perspective, early access to those services is vital in terms of maximising those recoveries and supporting clients. Like I said, that there are support and rehabilitation team at Owen Mitchell is a service that is provided free to clients, but if the claim has merit, obviously we can access private rehabilitation services, and that may be in the form of neurological physiotherapy, psychological services, adaptive equipment aids, and sometimes even housing. It depends entirely on the individual, the injuries, and their needs from both a short-term perspective but also a long-term perspective. It really is a wider, holistic consideration of an individual in terms of what their needs might be. Yes, there's a legal aspect to it, but really often it's the practical elements of what does life look like now, and how can someone access the community or maximise their independence in the home that matters to people and their families. Because getting back to some sort of semblance of normality, or whatever the new normality might be, is what people want to look for, and giving them some hope as well in terms of where things might improve in the future.
Adam, I think you're really putting a kind of human face on all of this, and really showing how important that support is at an early stage. And you've mentioned more than once about the role of family, and obviously Elizabeth and I both come from that perspective of supporting our husbands. So how do you see the role of family, partners, children in this process, as well as supporting the person who's had the brain injury themselves?
They are integral, really, and form a keystone to any sort of rehabilitation. And they're the existing support network for that client. So sometimes they are important in terms of being the go-between if there's challenges with communication in the early days, for example. But really, they help facilitate rehabilitation. And also, they feed into conversations in terms of what are the problems in the here and now, what might be the goals in the short to medium long term. And it's important to have those conversations with a client and an individual, but also the family, because there'll be different needs and expectations from every individual. But it's important that they're all in the mix, because they play an important part in identifying what rehabilitation or where support is required. But it is a really challenging time as well for everyone involved in the family dynamic. And it's also recognizing that it has its own impacts on those individuals. And sometimes we have to consider their needs as well, because if they're part of a support network, we need to make sure that that support network is strong and sustainable, because there is a lot of pressure on family members and even friends, depending on the individual. And yes, they're an important part of their rehabilitation and support, but it has to be sustainable, and we have to look after those individuals if we're going to get the best outcomes. So yes, it's always normally centered around the client, but we cannot lose sight of the support network and the family, because they're integral, not just to support the client, but to look after their health and well-being as well.
What kind of support do you offer the families?
It depends on the family in terms of what their needs are. And a lot of it is having the conversation to identify what those needs are. But it depends on the situation. If there's a lot of caring required, it might be looking at that individual in terms of any respite care that we can provide to support that individual, because no carer can work 24 hours, 365 days a week. It's unsustainable. But also psychological support as well, in terms of there is often a change in everything. In an individual, in terms of their potentially personality changes, and it can be quite hard for family members, friends, siblings, or even daughters and sons to comprehend and overcome and deal with that. So it really depends on the individual, but really it's about having early conversations around what are the challenges and how we can help support those individuals.
As Adam says, it's absolutely right that we look to support not only our clients, but our clients' families as much as we can. And as part of the litigation process, I always sit down with each member of my client's family and just talk about how life has changed for them too, and what support they've provided and what help they need. So it's certainly not just one client we have. It's part of the overall package that we look at everything. So it's so integral. It's so integral to what we do.
And Elizabeth, Julie, if I could turn that question back to you, really, in terms of what, and I appreciate it might be quite challenging to be open here, but what challenges did you have when those early days, when perhaps the other house were discharged home, for example, or when they're perhaps in an acute healthcare setting, what challenges did you have to manage personally?
How long have you got, Adam? I mean, I think that they are going to be, you know, some things we've covered in the podcast, but they're going to be similar to ones that most people that you work with will have come across. And I think that challenges at point of crisis and in hospital are slightly different from when someone comes home, and certainly when my husband came home. But I had very young children at the time. It's a huge overnight, devastating effect for the whole family. So I think on there's very practical things in changing roles, picking up new responsibilities, financial pressures, income changes, but then of course all the support that's needed, both to, you know, to my husband in his recovery, but then trying to keep the family together and supporting the children. We had to move country, my children had to start new schools. So I think it's that whole trajectory of change, and that's still going on in many ways as we're adapting to different stages in life. But brain injury is kind of part of our shared experience now. So it's still having that impact as children have moved out of home, as we're aging. Yes, I think it's stayed with us since then for the last 15 years and is still having that impact.
Yeah, Julia's right. It does change throughout the journey. And certainly when you really, really need, well, look, you need help all the way through, but it's on different levels. Certainly when Paul first came home from hospital, that was a huge switch up in our lives. And we really needed somebody who could just watch him because he couldn't go out. He couldn't necessarily be trusted to sort of do normal things because of the lack of a, you know, cognitive ability and also the communication issues. So we were quite fortunate in that on his private health, we managed to get somebody in who could help him out. And I'm truly grateful for that, because at the time I had two children as well, two young children, and it can be very, very overwhelming. But as our journey has gone on, then you do need more psychological help and support with dealing with such a life-changing situation that so many of our listeners and your clients will all have experienced.
I think it's also important to recognise in this conversation that there are hugely varying levels of support that people who've had a brain injury access. And I think that that's both in terms of how they've acquired their brain injury, if they can access support through services such as yourselves, but even postcode lotteries in terms of access to charities like Headway and NHS services. So I think that that can be, you know, very challenging in one way to see, to try and find what's available, and sometimes to recognise that it isn't as much as one would like. So I think that's difficult, isn't it? And I know that obviously if people do have access to a package, it can mean a lot more support, which is fabulous for those people. But we also recognise that not everyone will have access to that.
Absolutely. And I always say to clients at the initial meeting, really, that the benefits of pursuing a case is accessing that support, which will be funded privately. All of my clients want to some health back and want some quality of life back as much as possible. And we try and access that through the case by having treatment provided privately. But you're absolutely right, Julia. There's such a difference between what might be provided on via statutory services and what might be provided privately through litigation, which is one of the reasons why Adam and his team are so valuable in cases that we undertake, because there is a delay in litigation insofar as when we gather details of a case, we write to an insurer, we have to give an insurer 3 months under the protocol for these types of cases to investigate fault, and an insurer will not pay damages unless there is fault. So there has to be what we call negligence. And in that period, that 3 months is a vital window. It's a long time for somebody to go without support. So we're very fortunate that Adam and his team can step in for our clients and provide that support that we need before we get to the point where an insurer might wish to pay for some funding and pay for some rehabilitation.
We were going to ask actually how long a claim would usually take, whether there's an, I mean, obviously each one is different, but how long can somebody expect for it to take before that payout comes?
I often get asked that question, actually, at the start of every case. And understandably, people will want to know, well, how long is this journey going to be? And you're right that each case is different and it's very hard to give an answer. But I try and perhaps explain that the answer to the question is that we can conclude the case and we can recover a sum of money once we know what the future holds. And whilst that might sound a bit vague, to give your listeners a bit more detail, I can only advise my client to settle a case, and I can only advise my client what the case might be worth when we know what support my client will need lifelong, where my client might work, when my client might retire, what effect there might be on pension, where they will live, what support they'll need, what support the family will need. And all of these questions need to be answered before we can get to the point where we can advise somebody to conclude the case. And that can take years, unfortunately. It can take 3 years, up to 5 years or more, because it takes time for somebody to recover from a brain injury. And it takes time to really understand where somebody might need support and if and when somebody might go back to work and in what capacity. And it's that time and those investigations really that we have to pursue before we understand what the case might be worth and how we can, and what stage we can advise our clients to settle. Because if we don't, then we run the risk of undersettling a case so that there's not enough money there for somebody's lifelong support. Because if we settle a case too quickly without knowing whether our clients will need 24-hour support or live-in care or ability to work full-time, then we run the risk of the money running out. We use the word compensation. It can never be compensation. It's not a lottery win. It's a sum of money put in place for somebody's lifelong needs. And it's to try to put somebody back in the position they were before this awful event happened. And we need to make sure there's sufficient funds for the rest of somebody's life. And that does take time.
Richard, what you've highlighted there is why it's so important to have specialists like yourself to take that very long view of recovery. I see now after 15 years, and we've talked about before as well, that there can be sometimes not as many limitations as the medical profession might suggest at the beginning, but there can also be lifelong changes, and often are lifelong changes to people's capabilities. So taking that very long view is obviously something that's really, really important.
And if it's a childhood brain injury or a pediatric brain injury, often that process takes a lot longer, just because it takes longer to establish all those things that Rich has talked about in terms of care needs, support needs, and what the future might hold. So yes, it takes a bit longer, but it's for the right reasons in terms of identifying what the needs are and what care and support needs might be required at adulthood or during transition phases.
What if someone isn't insured? You know, if there's an accident and the person who's caused the accident doesn't have insurance. I mean, there's a lot in the news at the moment about how expensive car insurance is and, you know, how they aren't getting insured, which is awful. But I mean, what would happen in that situation?
And we've been monitoring that very closely to see the statistics and to see how that rises, because with cost of living crisis, of course, and you're absolutely right, Julie, when people can't afford insurance, that goes. And where does that leave somebody that's been involved in an accident with an uninsured motorist? Well, the answer to that is there's an organisation called the Motor Insurers Bureau, the MIB, who compensate victims of uninsured or untraced drivers. And the MIB is actually a fund paid for by all the insurers. It's a government-backed scheme where if somebody has been involved in an accident with somebody who's uninsured, or if it's a hit and run, so it's untraced, then somebody can seek redress under the MIB scheme, which works very similar to the way a case is pursued with an insurer.
How about life insurance? What does that have to play?
Life insurance is a separate policy of insurance that people can claim on depending on the terms of that policy. So it doesn't normally fall within the personal injury case, actually. It can be dealt with entirely separately. And interestingly, somebody who can claim on the life insurance doesn't then have to give credit for the claim on life insurance in a personal injury case. So it doesn't preclude or limit somebody pursuing a personal injury case. It's entirely separate. And it's something absolutely worth looking at in every case.
Another question, is there a time limit that people need to contact you after an accident before, you know, they kind of run out of time in which they could lodge a claim?
We always say this, the sooner the better. So as soon as possible after an accident, because we need to gather evidence. It's really important to speak to witnesses whilst memories are still fresh, because with the passage of time, memories fade and witness evidence can become less reliable. We may need to get hold of documents which aren't preserved. We may need in road traffic accidents to look at dash cam footage or CCTV footage in accidents on the road or at work, and that might be wiped. So the sooner the better to preserve the evidence and to speak to witnesses and to speak to our clients. But there is also a time limit to pursue a case, which is normally 3 years from the date of an accident. And that 3 year period means that court proceedings must be commenced by the third anniversary of the accident date. And if court proceedings aren't commenced by that third anniversary, the claim will normally be statute barred, so time barred, and somebody can't pursue the case. There are some exceptions. For example, if somebody's passed away, or if a child case, so the children's cases, normally the court proceedings must be issued by the child's eight, or the third anniversary of the child's 18th birthday. So by the time the child's 21. But I always say this, the sooner the better. Certainly don't wait to the last minute, because a lot of investigations and evidence gathering needs to take place, so that the closer to the time limit somebody would get, the harder it then becomes and the more challenging it becomes to find a solicitor who would be even willing to take on the case, because time would be against them.
Are you able to share some of the cases that you've dealt with, Richard, that have been successful to give our listeners a bit of an overview?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have settled many cases involving brain injury survivors over the years, and all of them stick with me for different reasons, really. One I concluded last year was particularly challenging because I acted for a client who was a passenger in a vehicle, and my client wasn't wearing his seatbelt. So that raises arguments as to whether he's what we call contributory negligent, so partly to blame for the level of his injuries. We didn't accept any deduction because of that. Because of his brain injury, he couldn't remember what had happened. The driver of the vehicle passed away at the scene, so the driver of the vehicle wasn't able to explain what had happened either. So it involved a huge amount of evidence gathering from witnesses to the collision, witnesses to the events leading up to the collision as well. And to make matters more complicated, there was another vehicle involved in the accident. What happened was that the car left the road and hit a tree. In those circumstances, we would normally pursue the insurers of the driver. But there was another car behind, and there was an allegation that those vehicles were racing. So we had to bring another driver into the case. The vehicles allegedly raced past a pub, so we had to go and visit everybody that was in the pub to see if we can get witness statements as to what they saw. And it was a hugely complex case that lasted about 5 or 6 years in total. And my client, because of his brain injury, lacked capacity to litigate and to manage his finances. So we needed a court of protection deputy appointed as well, which increased the time spent, but it was an excellent protection for my clients. But we ultimately were successful, and we secured a very large seven-figure sum of money, which was in place for my client to have the support that he needed, because he will need a support worker, he will need a case manager, he won't be able to go back to work full-time, and we're able to put in everything we needed to help him for the future. And even though the case settled, it was over 12 months ago now, I'm still in contact with him, as I still like to do with many of my clients, just to check in with him periodically on how he's doing and whether the support in place enough. And he's doing really well. He's volunteering, he's got back some quality of life, and that's what makes a job really rewarding, to know that we have been part of the team that has made a bit of a difference to his life.
That's really, really heartwarming to hear, and a hugely complex case, as you said, and a hugely traumatic one as well, which obviously he, I'm sure, will have had access to that kind of support as well through the services that you can provide.
Yeah, absolutely. And interesting on that case too, Adam and his team were involved as well at quite an early stage, because in the initial dispute as to who was to blame and which insurer would be involved, and this was a case as well where the Motor Insurers Bureau were involved, so who would really run the case on behalf of which defendant. So we didn't have access to that money at first to pay for rehabilitation, so our support and rehab coordinators in Adam's team were able to step in and provide that initial support and initial signposting that my client needed. So it was really valuable.
We were going to ask earlier, and I think you've given us a bit of a taste of my next question, as to why you got involved, both Richard and Adam, in specialising in brain injury.
As I mentioned, I suppose, in the last answer, Elizabeth, it was being part of that team really to make a bit of a difference. So I've been practicing for over 20 years, and during that period, most of my time has been spent in personal injury and serious injury cases. And to be part of the team that can make a difference to my client's life and to make a difference to the outcome is so incredibly rewarding. We're tasked at that crisis point with trying to put things in place to make a difference to the outcome. And ultimately, yes, the purpose of a claim for personal injury is to secure an award of money at the end of the case. But that's not what drives me, and that's not what gets me out of bed in the morning to do this job. It's to be part of the team, really, to try to put the rehabilitation in place, to try to make the difference, to get my client back to work or to live more independently or to engage better with his or her family. We are not just about in the business of securing a big sum of money at the end of a case, because none of my clients want a sum of money. All of my clients want their health back and quality of life back.
And Adam, how about you? Can you just give a bit of detail about why you do what you do and what drives you?
I'm actually a physiotherapist by background, and I head up the support and rehabilitation team at Irwin Mitchell. And the team itself actually is comprised of a real mix of clinicians from various backgrounds, nursing, social workers, occupational therapists. But I've known really from an early early stage that I wanted to be a physiotherapist. And part of that comes from a very sporty background and having personal experience of physiotherapy as a child, but also a very personal one in that my brother actually had a childhood bone disease, which required a lot of physiotherapy and support and medical management in the early days, which really opened my eyes in terms of what can be done to support people and people's capacity to improve and recover. I guess ignited a fire in terms of what interested me in biology, the human body, and just generally caring for people and wanting to support people. So that's why I got into physiotherapy, and somewhere along the line I managed to join Owen Mitchell and head up the support and rehabilitation team. But even though I'm still not doing the practical side as such, as i.e. the hands-on, I still feel like through my team and the work that we do and how we support clients and their families, that I'm still satisfying that need to help people and improve situations, because some of the work and outcomes that we achieve are just amazing in terms of what quality of life that gives and independence that gives.
Adam and Richard, thank you so much for coming to speak to us today with on a good day. And I think that your contributions today have really brought the human face to the roles of solicitors and the support team that you have within your firm in Owen Mitchell and with other specialist solicitors as well. And you've really shown the importance of engaging specialist solicitors when needed. So thank you so much. And you know, we will put information in the show notes about where people can find information to contact you and other specialist firms, because we know how important it is. And I think you've really shown us today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've really shone a light on something that actually I have learned so much from in this episode. And I think this will be of huge value for people to get this additional information, because it can be really overwhelming. You've given a really great overview of what you guys do and the importance of it and how you can really transform people's lives as well at the end. So thank you very much. I hope you guys enjoyed listening. Please do subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Share it with your family and friends. And if you could like and review, that would be amazing and really help make On a Good Day more visible and help it grow. You can also find us on social media. We're on Instagram, onagood.day, and Twitter, onagood_day. We also have a Facebook page too. So keep an eye on those links. Make sure you're following us. And until next time, have a very good day.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.